The 920 KVEC Podcast Network is presented by the Slo County Real Estate Podcast with Hal Swayze. Up-to-date information on the local real estate market on your time. New episodes weekly at the podcast link at 920kvec.com and wherever you get your podcasts. California DRE 01111911.
It's just about 4:07 on the Central Coast on this Tuesday, September 19th, 2023. I'm Dave Congleton. Paul Lewis will be back with us during the 5 o'clock hour. We did a segment last week about the possible impeachment of Joe Biden. We heard from a conservative today. We'll hear from a liberal. We'll give you both sides and you decide. This hour, author Katya Sengel was back on this broadcast. How many books are you? Is this the fourth book?
Fourth book.
I've interviewed her on each book. I'm not going to claim that we hang out together, that I know her very well. Now I know her very well, having read her memoir, Straight Jackets and Lunch Money. She is going to be doing an appearance on October 21st. Is that a Saturday?
I believe it is.
Okay. Saturday, October 21st at the library in San Luis Obispo. Straight Jackets and Lunch Money is brand new. You can get this book however you get books. Katya, nice to see you again. Welcome back to the show. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
This is a tough one for me, given everything you put on the page. And when you walked in, I said, you put it all on the page. You didn't, but apparently you held some things back.
I think a writer always holds a few things back.
How did you know it was time to put this to paper?
I think the book deals with my time as a 10-year-old in a children's psychosomatic ward at a Stanford Children's Hospital, and then my investigation 30 years later of that treatment. So I think it's my fourth book, but it was the first thing I ever wrote back in college when it was still very fresh. I wrote the part of the book that is from the child's perspective because it was very immediate. And I felt then just this need to tell these stories because I felt like we'd kind of been pushed away, the kids that people didn't want to see or hear from. But then luckily it did not get published then because it was, you know, typical 19-year-old, very... I didn't have the context. And so about 30 years later, I took it out again after my other three books and thought, you know what? I still think this is a really important voice we need to hear, but I want to put it in the bigger context of the history of juvenile mental illness, what happened before I was hospitalized, during the hospitalization, and then after, like, how has the system changed? And it was really interesting for me as a journalist to go back and explore that. And then the timing now with such high rates of juvenile mental illness and all of that is kind of serendipitous, I guess.
But then how did you feel when all this was done and you had the finished book in your hand? Any regrets about putting this story out there, or was it a burden off your shoulder?
You know, I guess I try not to ever have regrets. Fear, apprehension, yeah, but I'm not going to say I regret because it's a choice I made and I can't do it differently. And I think I've already heard from some people who it helped, and I think that is the key for me. Actually, quite a few people have told me they bought it for their therapists because it helped express what they felt but couldn't say in some ways. So if it helps some people, I think it was worth it.
I want to pull a story out of the book, and you reference this at the beginning. It's the idea that you can't save everyone, and you have to focus on the one that can benefit from you. Put that in context for me, please.
So it happens. I hate that, but it's just the reality. I was a volunteer at a writing program at a juvenile detention facility, and I remember there were some kids that were in, they were going to be for life. They had, after they phased out of juvenile detention, they would go on to the adult and they would do life. And it was, they were so tough. You kind of knew you couldn't reach them. So you'd focus on the kid who you could reach. And in the book, I kind of talk about how I hated that. But it was also the reality of that we kind of, there's some that we almost forget about because we give up on. And I guess ideally we wouldn't. We'd try and, but the reality is we do kind of go for the ones we think we can help. And in the book I go through and then think, well, maybe we need to go back earlier and get the kids earlier and then we can do a better job.
But then you circle around later in the book in your own circumstance. Basically, your mother chose your sister.
I don't know that I am. I think my mom was in a really, really tough situation. And she does have regrets on how some things were done. Luckily, as I and one of the other people point out there at the end, I'm still here and I'm doing fine.
Right,
so it's
but
okay. But
your mother asked you what kind of flowers you wanted on your grave.
Yeah, my mom definitely did tough love. And at the same time, though, yeah, and she said, you know, I've got one healthy kid.
Right,
and
I've got to focus on
yeah.
her.
Yeah, and I think nothing was reaching me. I was determined to do away with myself. And so I think sometimes that was a wake-up call. That stuck out to me. And that did reach me in a way some of the more loving responses didn't. So I don't know. It's really tough when you've got someone who's in a self-destructive phase and doing that. And yeah, so it sticks out and it's what I remember, but I don't know if it was the wrong thing to say because it did make me, it gave me some anger too, fighting anger that kind of could help me in some ways.
All right, so Katya, let's set the scene a little bit. You're the youngest of two children?
Yes.
All right, you grew up in the Bay Area?
Yes.
Parents got divorced?
Yeah, I was 5 or 6 years old when they got divorced, and then we were joint custody, my sister and I going back and forth, and there were some things that happened, but one of the main thing was my dad was severely depressed, and I became his caregiver. I decided it was my job to kind of save him. And he was unemployed, depressed, short on money. And I thought it was my role to stay by him, cheer him up, but also take care of things. So he'd complain about not having enough money. So I struck, by the time I was 9, I struck on the idea, because it started in 4th grade, I struck on the idea that, well, if he doesn't have money, I get a dollar for lunch every day, I'll just save that dollar, and slowly, I'll have this big pile of money, and I'll give it to him, and he'll be so happy. And so that was kind of how it started. I was 9, I was prepubescent, I didn't actually know anything about weight or looks. It was more, I needed an escape from a really bad situation and I couldn't find one. I do remember thinking about knives and things like that and was thinking, those are too immediate. I don't really, really want to die, but I want the adults to notice, to pay attention, and to do something. And so that's how it started. And then once I stopped with the lunch, I was like, let's see how far I can take this. No one's noticing. So then it got further and further until I was starving myself to death. And finally, I was put in the psychosomatic unit at Stanford Children's Hospital. It has a new name now, but that was the name at the time.
All right. Good place to pause as we are in conversation with author and journalist Katya Sengo. Her new book is a memoir, Straight Jackets and Lunch Money. Available however you get books. We'll come back and chat some more. This is Hometown Radio. If you're just joining us, my guest is author and journalist Katya Sengo. Her last name is spelled C-E-N-G-E-L. The book is called Straight Jackets and Lunch Money. It's a memoir of growing up and how at the age of 10, she ended up in the Roth Psychosomatic Unit. the Children's Hospital at Stanford University. It was 1986. I sense from the first segment, it's not easy for you to talk about this.
No, it's really hard.
Do you have flashbacks?
Not really. I think there's some things I just forgot. Like, I don't know if we want to get to the straitjacket part, but that I didn't even...
Sure, go ahead and tell the story. I think it's compelling.
So, I actually was at a juvenile detention facility and helping out as an adult in a writing program, and I saw a kid in a straitjacket. And aside from it being upsetting, seeing that, something else triggered in me. I was like, what? Why? That seems familiar. And I had to call my mom and ask her. And I said, Mom, was I ever in a straitjacket? And she said, yeah, you were. And so I don't know if I fully remember it or if I also remember it through her telling me. But I do, when I think about it, I stop thinking. I think I'm good about separating myself from my body. And so I kind of compartmentalize that and disassociate or something.
I think it would be helpful for you to explain to our listeners how a 10-year-old goes from having an eating disorder to being in a children's hospital.
Yeah, so I actually starved myself really slowly, and that's the only reason I survived. They said by the time I was in the hospital, I should have died, I think, a couple days before based on my weight. My heart should have given out. At the time I was admitted, they put me on all sorts of machines, and my brain had atrophied because what happens when you don't eat, your body starts to eat itself, its organs. And I did have an episode where I blacked out beforehand. But so they think because I starved myself so slowly, that was the reason I did, in fact, survive. But so it was to the point I actually had, I was not 10 years old. I started it at 9, but I was 10 years old when I went in. And so I actually had wrinkles on my nose and kind of it went concave in. Literally, people stopped and stared at me on the street. So it was very recognizable something was really wrong. And so that's kind of what, at that point, you have to have medical attention because they know. And my mom took me, the doctor, my mom had been taking me to the pediatrician and she'd been monitoring me. And she decided, okay, at this point, we need to put her in. And she had heard of the program at Stanford and thought it was the best program for me in the area at the time.
So this is not just medical, it's psychological.
Yeah, so that's what's really interesting. It was the psychosomatic ward. So it's not a closed psych ward and it's not a full just medical thing. So they treat it together. They treat both your medical symptoms of like my heart was unstable, so I had to have a heart monitor, those things, and obviously get some food in me, along with the psychological, okay, why are you not eating? What's going on here? And what happens when you start eating again? So they merged those together. And so on the ward, I was the youngest at the time I was there. We had more teenagers, and you got, of course, anorexics, bulimics, but you also got non-compliant juvenile kids with juvenile diabetes. So those were, and when I was there, they were boys. I don't know, they're probably girls too, but there were just teenage boys who had juvenile diabetes and were not dealing with it well for whatever reason. So they weren't eating appropriately with, and when that happens with juvenile diabetes, you can die very fast. So it was also something physically obviously needed to be treated, but also the mental, why aren't they taking care of themselves? Why aren't they doing that?
So why were you in a straitjacket?
So I didn't want to be there. And my whole purpose was not to, you know, I was trying to starve myself to death. So I fought treatment. When I started getting, initially I couldn't fight at all because I was in such bad shape. I was, you know, just kind of put on machines and everything. And then once I started getting some calories back in me, I started having some fight. And that's one of the things the psychiatrist I talk to talks about is, he says it's good when we have some fight in you, you know, but that also when anorexics start getting food back, the food has actually kind of, not eating has numbed them. It makes you passive. And so it takes away whatever pain you were feeling in some ways, and anxiety. So when you start giving them food again, that anxiety and all those feelings they can't handle come back. So I think all of that was coming back, and I was angry. And so I know I fought. I was fed through a tube. They stick a tube up your nose, and then it goes down into your stomach. And so I fought that in every way I could. I would pull the tube out, and then they'd have to put it back down, and then I'd pull it out. I'd turn the machine off. I fought treatment. And so at one point, I can't remember exactly what I had done that time. They couldn't figure out any other way to control me and were worried I would hurt myself. And so they put me in the straitjacket.
And you're 10 years old. You're 10 years old.
Yeah.
Are you having a sense of what is going on at the time?
I do remember.
Meaning they're trying to save me.
Yes and no. I think because there was a part of me, actually, I remember better the time they strapped me to the bed. So again, I had pulled the feeding tube out, and then I'd turn the machine off, and I'd done everything. And so finally, they strapped my wrists to the sides and my ankles to the sides, and I was really mad about that. But I do remember later in the night looking up and seeing a nurse still sitting there watching out for me. And there was a part of me that was also like, someone cares. Someone actually is there watching out and doing that. So it was this very mixed emotions of, I was very upset that this is being done to me. But at the same time, it showed, look, I'm making this really impossible for them, and they're still trying to keep me alive. So they do care. They have noticed me, because I think part of the problem before was I didn't feel anyone was paying attention or noticing me. So it's all kind of mixed up.
Others have noted this, and it's even referenced in the book, but there seems to be a connection between what happened to you as a young person and the fact that you grew up to be a journalist.
I think there's a huge connection. I think the first types of things I wrote were about this in college, and that's when I started on journalism too. And the stories I've always sought out are... some people used to call them tearjerkers, but I would seek out the sadder stories, the people I felt couldn't voice their own pain sometimes. And I would try and bring that out and bring attention to people I thought that sometimes society would rather not pay attention to and forget. And so almost all the stories I did, in some way, when I was writing this, I could see connect really back to, because I've almost always come up with my own story ideas. There's some I'm assigned, but a lot I come up with, and I'm trying to bring voice to some of these people who just are pushed away, maybe.
One of the things I would point out as we get ready for the news break, and we'll come back and chat more with Katya, is the book is Straitjackets and Lunch Money. Only part of the book is about what happened to Katya as a young woman. What we'll pick up on when we come back is the other part of the book is, as a grown woman now, an established journalist, going back and talking to some of the people who were involved in her medical treatment, some of the people that she actually met at the Stanford Hospital, and what happened to her as a result of everything. There's a lot. And again, let's remind folks, please, what's happening October 21st.
There will be a reading at the San Luis Obispo Library at 2 p.m. I'll be in conversation with fellow author Mark Parsons.
And you can get your book however people get books.
Yes.
All right. Off we go. We've got news and traffic and weather. More of our conversation, Katya, followed by a conversation at 5:05 with Paul Lewis. We are so busy, but not to worry. We will get it all in. I'm Dave Congleton on AM 920, FM 96.5, News Talk, KVEC. Glad to have you with us on Hometown Radio. I'm Dave Congleton, continuing our conversation with journalist and author Katya Sengel. For her fourth book, she chose to go personal, drawing on her own childhood. And the result is Straight Jackets and Lunch Money, available however you get books. Who's your target audience? Who'd you write this for?
I think for the kids, mostly for but it's actually an adult book, but I guess it was for children or adults now who felt, anyone who felt kind of not heard or struggling with mental illness, but then also families who are dealing with, particularly families or any kind of caregivers dealing with children with mental illness. So to be truthful, pretty much anyone in this world at this point has some connection. That was one thing a reader told me. She was like, well, almost everyone has someone with mental illness in their family and can relate. So,
but in your case, there was a family history. It says it's my birthday, May 12th, 1953.
Definitely, yes. Yeah. So my dad, when he was growing up, and it's a story he told me when I was a little girl. So it was about, and it impacted him hugely. And they talk about childhood trauma and how it impacts you later in life. And then, so his uncle had... served in, I forget which war it was. I think Korean War. Anyhow, his uncle was having some issues with depression and other things and ended up actually killing my dad's two cousins. Then he killed his wife. Then he killed himself. In between, he did call the police, but they were not, by the time they got there, everyone was gone. And it was a small town my dad was growing up in, or a small community. I don't know if it was I'm not from the same area, but he said at school they made up like kind of a chant about him using his last name, and he just got teased endlessly because everyone knew about this, and it was all over the papers, and those were his cousins. And at the time he had told me they were two little girls, but when I was going back and researching it, and at the time, me and my sister were two little girls, and our dad was depressed. So again, it kind of impacted me in that way, and that it really scared me. But when I went back and did the research, it wasn't clear if it was a little girl and a little boy or two little girls, because one of them was named Jackie, I think, and even the certificates mixed it up. One newspaper had it as a boy and one as a girl, and the age is even a little wrong, so I'm not sure.
So when you hear that story, how does that impact you?
Yeah, when I was a kid, because this is when I was 9-10 years old, and my dad was severely depressed, couldn't get work, didn't leave the house, just kind of sat and stared at a blank TV screen, and I, again, felt it was my role to cheer him up and try and get him better. And then hearing that, thinking, I remember being kind of scared to go to sleep because the children were killed in their sleep, and just thinking, he's really depressed. What's going to prevent him from doing something like that? And I don't think that was his intention at all. I think my dad was so hurt by his own trauma. He didn't really realize... he didn't have the emotional capacity to kind of understand what he was doing to me by telling me that. It was just something that was on his mind, and he mentioned it. And then I was left to kind of sort that out on my own.
Katya Sengel on this broadcast. The book is called Straight Jackets and Lunch Money, a personal memoir. Find it or however you find your books. So we've talked a little bit about your childhood. We've talked a little bit about you ending up at Stanford University at the age of 10. But the other part of the book is, as an adult, as an established author, you decide to revisit this and revisit some of the people.
Yeah, I think that was the most interesting for me and the easiest for me to talk about, too, because once I put on my journalism hat and I get out my notebook and my pen and my recorder, it's like a remove from this a little bit. And I'm not the patient. I'm the journalist. But it was weird because I was the former patient. So I was relating to these doctors in a way they'd never related to me before. And it was fascinating because there were some who outright refused to talk to me.
Why?
They would never, I basically had to stop communicating. They would never tell me. They just said that I don't want to take part in this. And I tried again. I did the journalism thing on pushing it and got the same response. And so I don't know. Afterwards, I thought maybe it was because at first I pushed to like for an in-person meeting because it, as a journalist, you know, it's always better in person than over the phone or whatever. And then I'm like, oh, great. Wait, I was in the psychosomatic ward. They're a psychiatrist. Maybe they think I'm going to like harm them or, was like, I had to think from a different perspective at that point. And maybe they thought I might have some anger toward them or something like that. I don't know. But then there were some who were very generous with their time. Dr. Steiner, who as a kid, I hated him because he was the head psychiatrist at the ward and kind of like God, he decided everything. And so I just resented him. But I was actually scared to meet him because he had been like God in my life when I was young. And I found him really interesting. And he was really, he really explained things to me. And I was able to see things in a way I'd never thought. He was the one who told me about how when you start feeding someone who starved themselves, how the anxiety comes back. So you can't just feed someone. He told me a lot. He really believed strongly in the psychosomatic, working those two together.
But he is also the guy that when you reach out to him, he suggested lunch.
Yeah, which I found ironic.
Was it you thought that might have been intentional?
Yeah, I was like, really? Someone who was in for an eating disorder and you're going to meet them for lunch. And I did think maybe he was testing me. And I still, to this day, when I'm anxious, I have trouble eating. My stomach closes up. My body physically just closes down or something. I can't really explain it. But so I was really dreading it even more when we had that because I'm like, he's going to be watching me the whole time and such. And then I actually ended up being able to eat and talk. I also hate lunch interviews because it's hard to take notes. but yeah, so it was, and he did do some other things where it was like, I actually interviewed him another interview at his office because he was still working as part-time as a psychiatrist. And I tried to sit in a seat that was like closest to the door and he moved me. So he still kind of clearly wanted to be in control. And I still kind of was feeling like I might end up in the patient chair or, you know, it was hard. Right. The boundaries had changed. So it was actually interesting. And like some other of the doctors I tracked down, they'd talk to me about things. They're like, oh, yeah, you know, like Dr. Steiner's wife. And I'm like, no, I don't know Dr. Steiner's wife. I'm a patient. I wasn't one of your colleagues. So it was weird because as a journalist, they almost thought of me as a type of colleague or something. But as I was coming at it as a journalist, but also a former patient. So it was interesting.
But just to be clear, in your time at Stanford, you were not mistreated.
No, not at all. No. I have total, as a kid, I resented them trying to save my life. But obviously, I'm very grateful for that now. I think how the things they did the best they could. I think everything's like so hard. But no, I was never mistreated.
How long were you at the unit?
More than 100 days, so it's more than 3 months.
And what was it like for you coming out?
Oh, that was hard. Basically, it was the beginning of fifth grade. It was most of fifth grade. I joke, I don't really know my multiplication tables. There's this missing part of my education because I did not attend school while I was at the hospital. When I came out, I tried to go back to my old school, and I remember all the kids just stared and not picked on me, but they were curious. They didn't understand. And so I then refused to go to school and my mom had to find me a different school because I wouldn't go. And then I went to a much smaller school for the rest of fifth grade. And then I integrated into a bigger school again, sixth grade, but totally new area. My mom was with my stepdad then, so we could use his school district. And so there were kids. None of them knew me. None of them knew my history. And that's kind of how I kept it. I remember in high school, a kid came up to me once who I hadn't seen since fifth grade and wanted to try and talk to me. And I actually completely blew him off and kind of pretended I didn't know him because I didn't want to go back. I don't know if I completely said I didn't know him. I just didn't want to talk to him because I didn't want that to haunt me.
Hmm. Would you mind reading a section from the book?
Yeah.
All right, this is called Straight Jackets and Lunch Money, available however you get books.
I'm actually going to read the beginning part.
Good. I was drawn in from your writing from the beginning.
So it's called the first chapter, The Prisoners, 2012. It was the straight jacket. I had forgotten it. I'm not sure how. Having your arms held forcibly immobile against your body is not something you would think one would forget. It is especially hard to imagine someone like myself, someone who hates to lose control, forgetting having been forced to watch as others took control. But I had forgotten how they overpowered my brain and my will. They took my anger and wrapped me up in it, forcing me to absorb the pain I needed to release. I was 10 years old. A captive. A prisoner. The straitjacket makes you helpless to protect yourself. To defend yourself, to hurt yourself. How do you forget something like that? I don't know, but I did. I had forgotten about the straitjacket until I saw them forcibly restrain another child, a boy, a teenager. He was fighting them. I didn't want to stare, but I had to look closer. The stiff white contraption that was holding his arms unnaturally at his sides seemed familiar. That's when I remembered. I had seen it before. I had felt it before. Should I read a little more?
Sure.
Okay. More than two decades had passed, but a memory was coming back. I wasn't sure if it was real. Real was what I was seeing now, a black teenager incarcerated in a youth detention facility in the greater San Francisco Bay Area for a crime I was not supposed to know, being forced into a straitjacket. As an instructor in a weekly writing program at the facility, I'd been warned against inquiring about the youth's crimes. I hadn't been volunteering with the program long, but I knew already it was better not to ask too many questions of the children, especially when you had no answers you could give them.
Yeah. Katya Sango, Straight Jackets and Lunch Money. She spells her last name C-E-N-G-E-L. You can get this book however you get books. We'll come back for a final segment right here on Hometown Radio. We have been spending the hour with author and journalist Katya Sengel. The book is Straight Jackets and Lunch Money. You can get the book however you get books. So you went out and you revisited. You went back and you interviewed some of the people. What did you learn that you didn't know already?
You know, I hadn't known that the psychosomatic unit was kind of a semi-new idea. It developed a bit in the 70s, and Stanford was maybe the second or something. So I didn't realize it was so kind of revolutionary at the time. I hadn't thought much about it. I just thought I was in the hospital. I didn't realize. I knew it was a separate type of unit that was associated with mental illness because there was definitely a stigma, but I didn't realize it was psychosomatic and the importance of that and how that fit into the historical context, and that now we kind of think of, oh, yeah, of course, mental and physical go together. But the strange thing is we think that, but we don't treat it. It actually was better for treatment back when I was being treated than it is now for kids because insurance likes to separate it into it's either mental or it's physical. So like I was talking earlier about the non-compliant diabetic teenagers who had the medical part, but also the mental on why weren't they taking care of themselves and eating. And so now they'd just be put in the mental part, but those doctors wouldn't know how to treat the mental part of why this is happening. If you put them just with the mental part, they wouldn't know how to handle the physical part of keeping them alive.
So what would have happened to you today?
So that's why
10 years old.
You know, I tried to track that down, figure out, okay, where would I go? And a lot of the doctors told me there really isn't a place. It was even hard back then because of my age. I was so young. They said it's hard even now to find a place where I would have gone. A lot of the kids like that are unfortunately going to emergency rooms and they're being stabilized and then they're released. The unit, it's not Roth anymore, but it has a new name now, but there is a unit. It does specialize just in eating disorders. So I guess I could have gone there, but as soon as I'd gained enough weight, was stable, they would have released me. So I would have only stayed a couple weeks. I was in pretty bad shape, so it might have been as much as 3 weeks or so, but not as long as I did otherwise. And they would have really not had as much time to explore what was mentally going on that was doing this.
Does the older Katya now beat up on the younger Katya? Like, how could you do this? Look what happened to you. You almost died.
No, because to be truthful, it got me out of the situation I needed to get out of. It was, I don't want to say constructive, but it was in a way. I mean, I found 10-year-olds have to live with, you know, do what they can, and they're not adults. They can't take care of themselves in the same way. So,
No. If you don't mind, talk a little bit about your sister. I'm curious, why you and not her?
You know, I think it's more just a personality thing. I'm very similar, my mom says, in personality to my mom. And my mom had been the one kind of taking care of my dad before they divorced. And so I think somehow I just slipped into that role very easily. She wasn't there anymore. And so I became that person. It was just, I had the personality that was kind of the caregiver one that did that. And my sister was able to, she had a different personality where she could kind of just not fall for my dad's tricks as much, or, you know, she could just distance herself a little. That said, though, my sister had a really difficult time in that she was then told to be the caregiver of me. And that's a 12-year-old kid being told to make sure her 10-year-old sister survives. And so it's a huge burden on my sister, and a very unfair one that was put on her.
And how's that relationship today?
We're not that close. We talk. We're just very different. We live in different parts of the country and live very different lives. So I love my sister and she loves me, but
do you talk about your youth?
No.
Do you wish you would?
No. It's easier almost not to, I think. There's certain things that just don't.
Do you think she'll read the book?
I dedicated it to her, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did feel, because when I wrote it at 18, I do feel she, like I said, she was given this unfair burden of being my protector. And so I did feel that's who, when I wrote the first version, I dedicated it to, and I still felt that's who deserved it. And so we'll see.
Mm. We were talking earlier about the connection between what happened in your youth and your career path that you chose. But I remember your book about Cambodia. Children. You write about children a lot. You believe giving voice to people.
And especially those who, with the Cambodians, they were adults kind of when I was telling their story, but I go back to what happened to them as kids to lead to some of the issues they faced as adults, and then also to what would happen to their children if they were deported. So there were people who had not made the best choices and run afoul of the law, and so they were facing deportation. But I looked at, well, how did they end up where they are? What had happened before? And what would happen to their kids if they're deported? So I always like to kind of see the context and the full picture. And I really like to think if we kind of start earlier with kids and we really give them the attention they need and pay attention to these things, maybe we can change that path so things don't go off course as much, and try and deal with things then instead of later, because sometimes you wait till later and it's kind of too late. So it really starts in childhood for a lot of this.
We remind folks, October 21st at the library, San Luis Library. You're going to be talking about the book. What are you going to be doing on the 21st?
Yeah, so I'll be in conversation with Mark Parsons, another author. He's actually a novelist, but wrote a juvenile fiction story that also had to do with very different, but also about a child dealing with some trauma and figuring out a way to cope with that in a unique way. So I thought it was an interesting partnership, Mark and I talking together, really focusing on young people a bit, and especially Straight Jackson's and Lunch Money, but also highlighting his book, The 909 Project.
And you're also going to be involved in the Central Coast Writers Conference the weekend before.
Yes, yeah. So there's a lot of writing events going on here in Central Coast in October.
As we start to wrap things up, Katya, what's your message to parents? Because the parents are the ones who are listening to you right now, not the young people. What do you want them to understand about all this?
I think to really listen and hear your child as an individual, and they can't always express it in words, but to look at their actions and just try to understand them as best you can. And even if you're not their parent, if you are an adult, who I think that's a big important thing for adults everywhere, to pay attention to all kids and to mentor kids and to kind of look out for them, because it's all of our responsibility to take care of the next generation.
What's next?
Oh, I'm thinking of doing some short story collection.
Really?
Yeah.
Going from nonfiction to fiction.
Well, you know, fiction has a lot of nonfiction in it in some ways.
And you're still teaching at Cal Poly.
Yes, I'm teaching journalism at Cal Poly.
Is there hope for this generation coming along? Let's end on a positive note.
Yes, I think there is. They some of them are actually much better at expressing themselves, I think, and asking for help. They definitely still suffer from some really high rates of mental illness and such, but I think they know how to express that better, and it's more accepted that you can talk about it. I think there's still stigma, but I think there's less than before.
Yay. And how about a website?
Oh, yeah. It's just my name, Katya, KatyaCengel.com.
All right, Katya, congratulations on the book. Keep us posted on your appearances. I would urge local nonprofits to bring you as a speaker. There's a lot to learn from your story. Thank you for sharing it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Off we go. We got news, traffic, weather. Paul Lewis is in the house. Get ready.
I always forget.
The 920 KBEC Podcast Network is presented by the Slo County Real Estate Podcast with Hal Swayze. Up-to-date information on the local real estate market on your time. New episodes weekly at the podcast link at 920kbec.com and wherever you get your podcasts. California DRE 0111911.